Still spring here in the foothills, but it's fire season up north, up in the boreal forest, Fort McMurray in Alberta. They've got a really serious situation there. It's been described, the forest there has been described as wanting to burn. With me in the studio is Craig Thomas. Craig is the conservation director of Sierra Forest Legacy. Craig, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me in, Alan.
What does it mean when a forest wants to burn?
Well, it generally means that you have, a vegetation type or types that are associated with fire over the long term. So you call them fire-adapted or fire-associated ecosystems. In the Alberta case, I think it's also, and it's discussed elsewhere as if you miss a significant number of fire return intervals. In other words, you have a fire-associated ecosystem, needs fire as a natural process for renewal and resilience, and you start suppressing those fires, and you do that enough times to where you've missed enough fire cycles that then it really wants to burn. So it means the fuel buildup, the fuel loading in those forests, whether it's standing dead trees or wood on the ground, is very dry and very ignitable.
Okay, you've pretty much just summed up what we're going to be talking about for the next hour. So I will point out, though, that one of the characteristics of a fire that wants to burn is, well, it's fire-adapted, and it means it depends on fire. So something you might find are closed cone conifers, where the cone, normally we're used to, ponderosa pine around here, the cones ripen, they open up, and the seeds fall down. The seeds have these little wings, and the wind blows them here and there. But other pines, the cones don't open. They're glued together. They're serotonous. They just don't open right away. And it takes some heat. And we happen to have some species of pine right here in the foothills that have closed cones. One of the fun things to do is collect the cones and you put them onto a frying pan, very, very, very low heat, and just leave it, forget about it, and then about an hour later, there's this wonderful incense going through the house, and you realize it's coming from the kitchen, and the cone has opened up, and it's giving off its incense, and also it's opened up, and in the frying pan are all these seeds. So that cone is waiting, hoping, if you will, for fire.
Yeah, the giant sequoia is another one that, you know, we have a grove on the Tahoe National Forest and on the southern end of the forest, American River Ranger District, and those giant sequoia cones need heat to open up, and then they literally rain seeds down on the landscape. So there's, you know, we're talking about fire regime and fire frequency and what type of vegetation we have on our landscape, and it's variable as you go from the lower end of the mountain range, you know, north to south, and it's variable east and west.
So let's get into fire regime. In other words, how often the forest burns and what type of fire it is that's
right.
Burning. So there are a number of factors, a number of variables, and one of the most obvious is the amount of fuel on the ground, the fuel that's available to burn. What are the variables that go into determining how much fuel is available?
Well, frequency is a big one. So vegetation in California is involved with a variety of regimes and a variety of frequencies of fire. So in higher elevation, where you have big snowpack, there's a lot more variability. Like in Red Fir, it's 12 to 69 years between fire intervals. So that's a large scale amount of variation. In other places,
let's get to that just so people know what we're talking about here. The Red Fir Forest, that's the snow forest. When you head up Highway 20 and you get up to about 6,000 feet, you get out of the white fir and into the red fir. Those are the ones that have the lichen that starts 10 feet up. They start 10 feet up because they're used to having 10 feet of snow there.
Right.
The lichen don't like to grow under the snow. So that
in Nevada City, if imagine, the pine and oak forests that you still see in the extent of what was here in earlier days, that for the sake of discussion, let's say 8 to 12 years, or maybe less than that.
So that burns fire much more frequently.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean every single acre, as far as you can see, burns every 8 to 12 years, but in a large watershed, you get a lot of fire in the system on a pretty regular rotation. So that 8 to 12 years is some variability. A fire cycle would be all of a particular area you define has had fire in it in one rotation. But one way or the other, lower elevation, pine and oak forest, we had a lot of regular fire in that system. Higher elevations, maybe less frequent, more intensity, more.
And it goes around because, sure, if you burn frequently, you're not going to have much fuel on the ground. If you don't burn very frequently at all, well, not many fires, but that fuel just builds and builds and builds. So what if, and here's a leading question if there ever were one, what if you've got a forest like we have down here in the foothills, pine, cedar, you have a short fire regime. In other words, it's used to burning, let's say, and so it's used to burning, let's say, every 10 years or so, but you suppress that fire.
Yeah, then so when that happens, and you know we're talking a lot of acres in California are either suppressed. There's two different things: fire suppression, and say you've got a fire that's coming into Grass Valley, and we thankfully have Cal Fire there, and we're protecting people's homes and lives. You know, that to me is the best picture of what suppression still is and has value for. Moving that out to wildlands, then that's where those fuel buildups can just get to a magnitude where the fires are pretty much unstoppable that we're seeing these days, because the amount of, it's called fuel loading, it's basically the amount of fire that's not being consumed by decay, that's stacking up. It's, you know, there's, and it can be two things. It can be material on the ground, or it can be an extensive amount of small trees in the understory that aren't being taken care of in regular fire cycles that would normally, they would be taken out by fire. And when fire is excluded, then you get this, you hear a lot of people talking everywhere, you'll hear the Forest Service every time you hear them saying the density of understory trees is really out of whack. So that is a fuel element in itself, besides dead material like cones and branches and grass and stuff on the ground.
A few years ago, there was a big fire over by Los Alamos, you know, the nuclear weapons lab. And people were concerned there might be some radiation spread if it got into the lab itself. It didn't. But I was up there just less than 2 weeks after the fire. I'd been there just before the fire, visiting one of the national monuments, and then I went back to see what it looked like. And the thing was that you could see what had burned was what we call dog hair. All these very young trees, skinny, just sitting cheek by jowl. Hundreds of trees per acre, tiny little ones, but...
yeah.
All of these trees are waiting to burn.
I think that's a fair, you know, it's not, of course, we don't see that on every acre, so we're generalizing here, but I think it's a very fair generalization that you have increased fuel loads, and it's the material on the ground, and it is those thickets of trees that, particularly in a frequent fire regime, you would not see the kinds of densities we're seeing when we walk through the woods these days. And that is, you know, it becomes highly flammable, and then it's what they're often called ladder fuels, right? So you have surface fire, can get into the smaller trees, it can ladder or climb up into the crowns of trees, you put some wind behind that, and you know, that's where we've seen with in these areas that are really out of whack, and we get fire weather that contributes, and pretty soon you get something like the King Fire that, you know, some of it burned reasonably and some of it burned like we'd never seen before, 56,000 acres in 6 hours.
Bringing it back to the Alberta fire, they have seen some horrendous fire weather, so that it's not just, they do have the same problem we do with fire suppression, where fire's been kept out and the fuel builds up, but there are parts of the forest there that are burning that have not been suppressed. They're so far from anything.
Yeah.
And they are also burning. So it's a very serious situation there. Adding insult to injury, when you have this long, when you've extended the fire return interval, normally you're talking about fuel that's been on the ground for a while, but only for maybe 10 years or so on average. So it's still kind of wet. But if it's been 50 years since the last fire, that is really dry, seasoned firewood now.
Yeah. Well, it's, and also with the dry period that we hopefully are coming out of, but there's no guarantees, that fuel moisture of the fuel itself, just the short extent measurement of fuel moisture is, last year I was talking to fire folks, they say they've never seen anything so dry.
I haven't been on a fire for a while, I have to admit, and so I don't know if they still do this, but they would take out dowels, like half-inch wooden dowels, and weigh them, and there's so much water going in and out, that there's actually a difference in the weight of the dowel between morning and evening.
yeah.
evening. It's been drying in the sun all day.
So I think fire weather, these extended dry periods, the fact that we've got 39 million people in California, a lot of them like to live where we live in the Sierra Nevada, so that's a fire risk. Just the fact of increased human population increases fire starts. And then you still have lightning operating. And what we haven't had, what you know, we were talking about earlier, Alan, is that the Sierra Nevada mountain range, let's just peg the Sierra Nevada mountain range, the uplift at 10 million years ago. And you think about that long of a history, and as soon as that, you know, none of us were there, right? But you can envision that as that mountain range grew, it started to have a serious effect on weather patterns. You can assume storms. You can assume lightning. That's all we can do. Is that sounds rational to me. But we know for a fact that fire has been on this landscape just by looking at carbon in meadows. And, you know, they've done enough studies to know that for certain it's been around thousands of years. And Native Americans have a long history of fire use, a strong relationship of living with fire and using fire for multiple benefits.
People described how this is back in the 1800s, they looked at the Sierra and be covered with smoke.
Yeah. Yeah, it's we live in an era where there's been a lot of fire suppression, so we really don't have any idea what in 1800, the description of actually tourists coming to see Yosemite and places like that. We had a tourist industry there when we were traveling around in boats and trains, and they would come and get off the ship and they couldn't see the Sierra Nevada, the thing they wanted to come visit. And so the estimates of the kind of fire that was happening, and I call that ecological fire, that was people and the landscape itself burning via lightning, roughly 4.4 million acres a year.
How much burns now?
And, well, it depends on the year and the weather, but, you know, we'll have, and that's a different kind of fire, too. Let me get to that point first, because that fire was fire that had associated with vegetation over the millennia. So we don't see these, all of a sudden it's one type of vegetation, say it's conifer forest, and then next week it's something else. I mean, those systems were stable because of the relationship with fire over the long term. Yes, we had glaciers. Yes, we had climate change before fossil fuel, too. But now we have, you know, climate change and dry periods exacerbated by climate change. And we've got a lot of people, which means more fire starts. So there's reason to be concerned about how this all comes together. But back, I just want to let people know that back in the old days, you know, pre-Western movement and pre-European settlement, what John Muir talked about when he walked into Yosemite, that pristine landscape had a huge amount of fire in it, and that fire is what made it that way. And it was that relationship over time. Didn't mean we didn't burn out trees, didn't have pockets of high severity, didn't mean any of that, but we had a level of stability where the systems were intact and remain so, with some variability and diversity happening all the time because of fire's interaction.
It's interesting that just as we are having an effect on the world's ecosystem right now, driving some species into extinction, Native Americans did the same. It might not have been extinction, but they certainly extirpated species in certain areas because what was here when the Europeans arrived was a very human-dominated system using perhaps the oldest tool people have ever used, which is fire.
Yeah, and using it long enough to have an effect on species composition. So it's, for me, I look at that as there's humans very much a part of their landscape on a daily basis. That's the other thing, that although there still are Native American groups all over California that are using fire actively, but, you know, we're not anywhere near the kind of scale of what the vegetation is calling out for in terms of fire for rejuvenation, fire for fuels loading reduction, and things like that. But there was a lot of fire use in that era. And then the 1850s happened. And it's that era where, you know, we started moving into the early 1900s, where fire suppression became the activity of the day. And we got so good at it that it, you know, there was a lot of landscapes that have been fire excluded for over a century in the Sierra Nevada, strongly fire-associated landscapes that have been fire excluded for over a century. The other unfortunate part, and you know, I'm not pointing a hard finger at this. We all were in a society in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and up until the end of the 80s that saw old growth forest resources as a very rich, a very rich economic entity, and, you know, utilization of old growth lumber, and we were basically not much different than private industry. We were lining up large blocks of the Sierra Nevada and to be regenerated, and that those old trees had a, you know, they took a huge hit in terms of what the forest structure looked like in the 1800s compared to what it looked like in the early 19 and late 1900s even.
When a tree is growing taller and taller, it will self-prune. It will drop, probably because it's just shading the mountain. They say, hey, we're not getting any shade. We're going to die. So the limbs towards the bottom of the tree will fall off. And it's because of those limbs that you get knots in the wood. That's what you're seeing, is where the limb came out. So if it self-prunes and drops a limb and then grows for another 150, 200 years, that last 100 years or so is going to have no knots. And that's going to be extraordinarily valuable.
Much thicker
wood.
Bark, too. Much, you know, bark thickness is very much a part of fire resiliency. And it's what you see, the big, large pine, sugar pine, ponderosa pine, black oaks, these species are used to regular fire, develop a thicker bark more quickly. They don't see fire coming at them every 10 years like you get up, you know, I mean, every, you don't see the upper elevation forests looking the same and behaving the same in terms of their structure because they don't have as frequent fire. But down here, like say in Grass Valley and in the lower end of the national forests, the species represent what the fire regime worked out with those species over millions of years, over tens of thousands of years for sure. And humans had a big part of that down here, where the, you know, the human population was significant.
Not only did humans have a big part of it, but the trees themselves have a big part in what is the fire return interval.
They selected.
And they make conditions. So with the ponderosa, it's a pine. One of the ways to identify a pine is you look at the needles, and even if it's a one-needle pine, it's got this little papery sac at the base that the needle grows out of. With our ponderosas here, three needles grow out of that sac. It's called a fascicle. And what that does is when they drop their needles, that fascicle holds all three dead needles together. So when they pile up as litter, they cannot just squeeze together as tightly. It literally keeps that litter layer much airier. And because it's airier, it burns much more easily and hotter. So they are also encouraging that frequent fire, easy to burn situation on the ground.
Yeah, so this is all, what we're talking about here is how, you know, in the social, cultural arena of humans living in these environments, or humans living, you know, around the state trying to manage these environments, is how do we develop a new relationship with fire? How do we overcome some of our, both the, you know, the logging history and the fire exclusion, fire suppression history, and develop an active relationship with fire to where we, you know, we act and behave as if it's a tool that can do good forest resiliency work. Good, it's not just about fuels either. It's, I mean, with the majority of our forest wildlife species have a relationship with the outcome of fire, whether it's cavity nesters and snags that have been killed by fire, or big cat faces where wildlife use that, or whether it's plant, you know, seed scarification for plant renewal. You name the soil, you know, recycling soil nutrients. These forests are strongly tied to the fire regime that they've involved with. And so that, you know, for us in the conservation movement, we're like, okay, we've had this history. How do we overcome it and get back to something that's more resilient and more science-based? And part of that discussion started about 20 years ago when I was talking with you, Alan, earlier about how I could fill up this sound room with fire ecology papers that have been published in the last 20 years that are basically screaming out for increased fire use. I mean, there is this one after another published, depends, you know, University of California, Forest Service, Rocky Mountain Research Station, you name it, across the country, all these fire-associated ecosystems have been fire-suppressed, mostly. Not in the southeast, interestingly, but elsewhere. A lot of suppression, a lot of fuel load, a lot of fire hazard, a lot of potential uncharacteristic burning. So, you know, part of our goal is to help society move to a place where we can recover fire use and install it in these systems for the benefit both of the landscape and the ecology, but also public health. That's one thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, what's changed since the 1800s is we also now have the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act is a very, you know, it's a righteous statute to protect, you know, the primary purpose is to protect public health. And which is a good thing, you know, go EPA. We don't want pollutants in our life. There's only one little problem, and that is that it also is aimed at and is restrictive of what's called PM 2.5 and PM 10 as a particulate matter, basically smoke as we see it from either a bonfire in our backyard or smoke from a wildfire or a prescribed burn.
And the numbers refer to the size. The smaller the number, the tinier the particle, and the more dangerous the particle. So small number is bad.
Yes. And so there is medical science. There's no doubt that a lot of smoke is trouble and an impact on public health. At the same time, we have an ecosystem that's calling out for a lot of fire every year. And so we're in this challenging period right now with a lot, you know, I'm working more with the California Air Resources Board and we're talking to Forest Service fire folks and we're looking at burn day availability and burn day utilization. You know, if we've got days, why aren't we using them? And if we don't have enough days, why is that? And going in those discussions right now very deeply. And we're seeing EPA at the highest levels putting out new proposed rules that are saying, you know, for using natural ignitions when it's safe and appropriate to do so, which the Forest Service and Park Service can do, use a lightning strike, in other words, for multiple resource benefits. You have good weather, you have staff on board, things are looking good. You can use natural ignitions for resource benefit, which could really be a great tool to get us to the ecological scale that we need to get to find that magic word called resilience. Resilience means you have fire in the system, but you're not converting it constantly. You have a stable system that can accept fire. But I think the challenging part then is to how we align with public health protection and smoke management plans and smoke guidance from the Clean Air Act with the Forest Service's mandates to enhance ecological diversity and restore resilience in these landscapes. So it's quite a challenging discussion, and right now it's very professionally healthy that we're doing this together. And I think part of that has been these extensive fires and the tree mortality in the South. It's pretty much kind of hit everybody with a wake-up call of, you know, we really need to look at all of how we're managing these landscapes, and increased fire use is a part of the deal. There's no doubt about it. We will never get there without increased fire use across this mountain range and the rest of California.
Let's take a quick break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back to continue the discussion. I'm Al Stala. This is Soundings on KVMR-FM, Nevada City. I'm speaking with Craig Thomas, the Conservation Director of Sierra Forest Legacy. We'll be right back.
Leather coat woman, look in the room and give me my blue suede shoes. Hand me my leather coat, please, honey. Look in the room and give me my blue suede shoes. I don't ever see you no more, darling. I swear before God that will be too soon. morning about 10:30. I knew it was something wrong. I couldn't even get in. I walked around to the back door. They tried to ring my bell. The things I saw, my love, I'm afraid to tell. Hand me my leather coat, darling. Honey, please give me my blue sweatshirt. I don't ever see you no more, darling. I swear before God it will be too soon. Come on, play me a little bit, Junior. Leather jacket, woman. Give me my blue shoes out the other room. Please give me my leather jacket, lady. What about my blue shoes in the other room? Cause if I don't ever darling, I swear before God that will be too soon.
Buddy Guy with Junior Wells. I'm Al Stollers. This is Soundings on KVMR FM, Nevada City. Speaking with Craig Thomas of Sierra Forest Legacy. Craig, we were talking about how there's, at least if nothing else, but there is other stuff, but there is the Clean Air Act that says you can't start that fire, it's going to cause smoke and people are going to be breathing it. Well, what happens if we do continue suppressing fire and not setting any fires?
Well, I think a lot of people are going to be unhappy, and including forest managers and conservation folks who want to see more fire use, but also the people, all of us, who breathe the smoke. The Clean Air Act leads to, air regulatory districts throughout California that manage the fire programs and actually grant authorities to burn. So it comes down to, the conversations we're having right now with air regulators and land managers is how do we get ecologically significant levels of fire back on this landscape and do the best job we can to protect public health. Part of that is through the seasonality of when fires can be used. Part of it is taking precautions for at-risk populations, communicating with the medical community about why fire ecology and fire use is critical. It's a whole bunch of really good collaborative conversations that have started. Smoke management planning is all about having the right conditions and the right weather and in doing the best you can do to have that smoke disperse. So that's a big factor, and we're all involved in that and care about that. Underpinning it all for me is that knowledge of the thing we just talked about, which is fire regime and fire return interval, and where are we going to be if we ignore fires need to be in these systems that we live in. And a lot of the acreage is not reachable by mechanical treatments. There's fuels work that many of you have seen who live around Nevada City, around communities where there's been mechanical fuels reduction, but remember, we have a huge mountain range, millions of acres. A lot of it's steep. A lot of it has no road access. So if we don't have fire as a tool in the tool bag, we're basically assigning those acres to whatever we wind up getting from lightning missions. And if we get them on the bad days with the bad wind, we could see a lot more uncharacteristic fire than if we had fire in the system. And that means we would see a lot of uncharacteristic, what we call mega emissions. So emissions that are off the chart from anything anybody's seen or had to live with are now occurring with the King Fire, the Rim Fire, the Rough Fire, fires of this scale and duration that go on to produce a magnitude of PM, like you mentioned, smoke particles, a lot of tonnage for a long period of time, weeks and weeks at a time. So that, you know, that is mitigated. You know, we are arguing and promoting public health through fire use. So that piece is definitely a part of the conversation. It's not a no-fire choice. It's a fire in where we might have something to say about how it burns. We're a partner with fire. Or fire where we don't have a lot to say and all we can do is get out of the way and then clean up the mess.
We've got the Clean Air Act and don't want to do anything to get to destroy the Clean Air Act. What other institutional roadblocks are there to prescribed fire? In other words, to slowly burning what needs to be burned.
Well, there's some really interesting things. Some have been around a while that people are paying more attention to, and that is the agencies generally. I'm talking Forest Service, because Park Service has had an active program for a long time. Fire is their primary management tool.
This is National Park
National
Service.
Park Service. And State Parks has an active fire program. But the Forest Service, you know, in recent years has been shifting to, you know, what they want to characterize as more ecologically based management. And so you get a lot of research in that area. And I would say there is a shift towards more disturbance based management in terms of, even if you're doing a timber, you know, if you're doing a mechanical thinning project, even today, the marking, ideally, if people are really on the ball, that what they're trying to do is remove smaller trees that are fuel ladders, and ideally they are doing that marking and removal as if they were fire. We want that heterogeneity, that diversity, the patchiness. We want those things, whether people are doing it in mechanical treatments or ideally a lot more of the landscape using fire to build that heterogeneity, which equals resiliency, into these landscapes.
Well, how closely can mechanical thinning mimic fire? Because with fire, among other things, you're really getting rid of a lot of those flashy fuels that start the fire in the first place, the kindling, the timber, the stuff that'll burn very fast, will be gone very quickly, but it's just hot enough to ignite the slightly heavier fuel, which ignites the heavier fuel yet. Yeah. So how doesn't mechanical thinning leave a lot of those flashy fuels?
There certainly is residual fuels, and I'll say a couple things about the mechanical program, because we, in Sierra Forest Legacy, we've been struggling with the logging program in the Sierra Nevada for 20 years. This is our 20th anniversary, and it's been there on day one, and it's still there. But we are seeing some shifting and some, you know, better ecological thinking. And what goes, climate change has got everybody all brains rearranged, because we're seeing fire size and dryness like nobody's ever seen. So it is a tough conversation right now. But you're right, the treatments, fire does a lot of things that mechanical treatment can never do. And we mentioned some of them in terms of rejuvenating plants and creating wildlife habitat. There's a whole bunch of things. And reducing fuels in a way that mechanical treatments don't generally do. That getting the surface and ladder fuels through fire use gets you to 80-90% of the fuel profile element that contributes to fire behavior. So if you can separate those things, burn the surface fuels and the ladder fuels, thin maybe those smaller trees out, and you've done a huge amount of work to limit fire behavior. There are, you know, there are arguments to be made that if you live on a mountain, you know, if you have a town on a mountaintop and you're on a steep south-facing slope, maybe at the upper part of that slope you want to rearrange some of that, protecting the biggest trees, the most valuable ecological trees, but you might want to thin that out more. That's always a site-specific conversation, and it has to do more with public safety and community safety than anything. But so there's active treatments around communities we're talking about out in wildlands. what mechanical treatments can do in places where it's legitimate to do is get those ladder fuels removed. And then there's always a debate about how much commercial volume needs to be removed to do the work. So we've been arguing about that for 20 years. We're always looking for solutions where we can monetize smaller material, the stuff that we generally don't argue about. Posting poles, biomass chips, things that, when you said there's a lot of fuel on the ground after logging, well, there's a lot of fuel remaining also after fire. It doesn't always consume. It'll kill those trees, and when they sit there, interesting to think about. We don't just need fire in these environments as a one pass. We need it in a frequency that will really build resilience. So 8 to 12 years in lower elevations. You would expect another, you're getting prepared to do your next fire project if you're talking about prescribed burning. What happens with logging is that, yes, there are piles, and then they machine pile them, and then we burn them in big piles, and we're affecting air quality when we do that. So there's some emissions trade-offs there, too, that are tough. We're looking at, can we figure out something to do with that material that could maybe be a carbon offset that could produce some energy or some heat. Otherwise, it's pile burn, and it's pile burned in, piles the size of this studio building, the whole building, big piles.
Big piles, yeah.
And we put all that up in the air. So, and that interferes with smoke days when we could be prescribed burning. So this is just an example of where these conversations can go. It is very complicated, and there's a lot, I'll say, never in my 30 years of doing this work have I seen more people, good people, from different perspectives trying to figure out what the heck to do because of fire exclusion, because of past management, because of fuel loading, and because of we need multiple options and choices in the tool bag.
But as you say, people are talking. You've got an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, with a number of agencies and environmental groups and individuals that really looks encouraging that people are saying, yeah.
It is very encouraging. We signed what we call the Fire MOU Partnership, and it's a memorandum of understanding with the Forest Service, Cal Fire, the National Park Service, Sierra Nevada Conservancy, Wilderness Society, Nature Conservancy, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity. Those were the startup initiating signatories. And now we have the Bureau of Land Management. We even had the California Forestry Association join the other day. And basically what everyone has said,
even people might not realize that is an industry group.
That's a timber industry group. And that was got everybody's attention, and I think I know the reason why they joined is they accept this following thesis that we may care about trees for different reasons, very different reasons sometimes, but if we want any of them on this landscape, then we have to ramp up fire use by orders of magnitude compared to anything we've seen in order to have the resilience and to have forest systems survive fire in a changing climate.
I'm speaking with Craig Thomas of the Sierra Forest Legacy. I'm Al Stoller. This is Soundings. Let me invite our listeners to call in. If you've got questions or comments, something you'd like to say or you've been thinking about, give us a call at 530-265-9555. Please do it now because it's so traditional for folks to wait to the absolute last minute and then, hey, the last minute, it's just not time enough. So give us a call, 530-265-9555, to ask a question of Craig Thomas. And I wonder if we can get back to a little bit, realizing I'm just asking for ballpark here. What might we expect in a normal functioning ecosystem? How much fuel, how many tons per acre of fuel might we expect to see on the ground? What sort of fuel loadings do we see actually on the ground?
Okay, so here's the answer. It's variable, but let me explain some of that. So one, there's a social goal in fuels treatments that the Forest Service has established that's based on science, and that is how much fuel can you leave behind that has a certain flame length and will contribute to a certain rate of spread.
Flame length, how high does the flame get? How likely is it, therefore, to reach up into the crown?
So lower flame lengths, not a lot of tonnage is the goal for most treatments. It's 5 to 15 tons per acre, and they're generally, these days, are aiming at the lower end of that.
So can we think of that as more or less natural?
for a naturally returning fire regime that hardly any of us have ever seen, I could speculate that it would be.
So it's 5 to 15 yeah. tons per
but,
acre.
But again, that's for a particular vegetation type in lower elevation.
And ponderosa, mixed conifer, ponderosa, cedar.
You move uphill, it's a different ballgame and okay. more. So those are the goals, though, and those are fire suppression goals. Those are means if you get another fire on that landscape and you have that limited amount of tonnage, that maybe you can go in there and you don't need D9 bulldozers to deal with the fire. You can do it with hand crews and maybe let some fire burn constructively because you've got a low enough fuel loading. You have a limited likelihood that you're going to jump into a crown fire and have a problem you can't deal with.
So something, there's been some serious die-off in some of the national forests down south. Serious die-off here too, but down there even worse. What kind of fuel loadings are they looking at?
Well, that is, it's unimaginable unless you've seen an aerial or seen, you know, you Googled around and seen the photos that are there. But I'll just give you an example of a place where Sea Air Force Legacy spends a lot of time, and that's on the Sierra National Forest. So think east of Fresno. And in this particular landscape, the pine forests, you know, what looks like around Grass Valley in Nevada City, 80 to 90% all of the pine dead across the whole landscape.
80 to 90%. Eight or nine trees out of every 10.
Yeah. Like, it's incomprehensible in that extent. And, you know, there's a lot of interactions that have happened. The extent of the dryness, the beetles that then followed the dryness because the trees were stressed. So they're talking 400 to 600 tons. Of material per acre.
400 to 600 tons yeah. of firewood, essentially, per acre sitting on the ground. Or not on the ground, it might be still standing trees.
Standing in, falling over, and branches coming down all over. And they have, right now, they're struggling to be able to even clean it up because by the time they start, they've got another pile worth of material coming down. It's very dangerous. There's a whole lot of implications, and the place I'm thinking of is one place, Blue Canyon, but if you've been at Shaver Lake in the Southern Sierra, there's a pretty large forest community there, and these two canyons that are just essentially brown and dead are all below and downwind of where this community of Shaver Lake is. So people are legitimately very nervous about that extent of mortality.
Let me point out, we do have some calls coming in. I'll take them in just a moment. I do want to point out that there's a phrase, death by a thousand cuts. And I was down in the Southern Sierra 5 years ago or so. A gentleman was retiring because he was the ozone expert for the National Forest. And he was retiring, so he wanted to give a class. And I was able to get in on that class, and we just walked through the woods for a day looking at what ozone damage looks like. And I've been looking for it here and not really seeing it, but I have to start looking again. But down there, it's definite. So there, not only are they seeing, you know, fire suppression and disease, but there's also ozone damage. There's the climate changing. There is drought, like we've seen. So it's one thing after another. And so it's kind of, well, again, the death by a thousand cuts, where a tree or any species might be able to survive this insult and that insult, but you keep piling on the insults and you get 90% tree mortality.
Yeah, you know, the potential of losing a big chunk of the mountain range's forests that have been in place for a long time and the speed in which it's changing. Change always happened. There was always something going on with climate and vegetation and fire and other, and precipitation and, you know, topography. I mean, all those interactions are all, they're dynamic systems. But because of fossil fuels and climate change interaction with a dry period and with the stress, combined stressors like you mentioned, Alan, it has really got people's attention to figure out this is a whole new ballgame.
Hi, Carlo, you're on the air.
Hi, Alan, Lee Osborne here. Thanks for taking my call. I might have missed this. In your talks with, like, the loggers and Forest Service and things like that involving a harvest plan, has there been any discussion about getting away from replanting large swaths of single species of trees to that seems to be a real problem when disease and things come through, and therefore heightening the fire danger.
Thanks for your call. What I'm going to do is ask you to take the answer on the air, and I'm going to bring you down. Thank you, and I'll bring in our next caller. So go ahead.
Very, very good question, because a lot of what happens in these fire events, well, Industrial Timberland has a plantation forestry program that follows the clear cutting that happens, and folks are familiar with that, I'm assuming. But after these big fire events, then the question is, so what do we do? And the history of that, and I'm speaking on Forest Service land, in landscapes I'm familiar with, the Rim Fire being one of the most recent ones, we had some pretty big and lengthy discussions about how many times, say, the Stanislaus National Forest, so think east of Sonora, has burned since, say, the 1950s over and over and over again. The Forest Service has gone back and planted high-density plantations back on that same ground, burned them up again, planted them again, burned them up again. So it's an excellent question. I wish the answer was easy. There is a desire to have conifers back on Forest Service land, and there's also a desire to have that be resilient in today's world. So we are definitely engaged in conversations about, can we clump that distribution of trees? Can we try hard to protect smaller units while we get fire back in the system earlier, and then let fire and future trees, which will regenerate and seed themselves, and humans can be involved in that, both with the fire and the planting, but do it more thoughtfully where we think we might hold on to more water. So in snow pool pockets and places where it makes ecological sense to at least think we can guarantee getting some young trees up to maturity and cone producing age while we're integrating fire back into that system, so that we start out trying to focus on resiliency early on. And to the Stanislaus, I'm just using this example because I'm in the middle of it, to their credit, they have adopted at least looking at a variety of ideas like that on the landscape. So people are paying attention to it. The uniformity of a plantation forest that's connected tree crown to tree crown is an extremely flammable structure, depending on time of year and what's been done around them. So folks have known that for a long time, and building heterogeneity and disrupting that uniformity is a major landscape goal for the Forest Service. So it seems what we're arguing, and I think what your question was asking, is yes, we don't want to create the conditions that are highly flammable again. We want to start with heterogeneity in a planting strategy and in a fire strategy from day one, and move away from what we used to do, because it's generally not working.
Kevin Moore, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Steve Sack. You know me, Alan.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you.
How are you? You know, back in the 80s, we had the 49er come ripping through here in Rough and Ready, and, it started over in North San Juan, and it went through Wildwood and made its way up here, and we had it for a week, and it actually came back twice in the period of a week onto my property here. And at one point, Chief Fire Man from Rough and Ready, Gannon, came out in his private car, and he looked around and he said, "Wow, you don't have too much to worry about, do you, Mr. Sack?" And he was looking at my stone house that has a corrugated metal roof on it. And it's true, I wasn't worried about the house that much. It's really fairly fireproof from the outside, though, of course, could catch from the inside. There's wood inside.
We're talking with a stonemason here, I'll point that out.
Well, a stonemason with a very good idea about how to live with fire and live in a fire-prone landscape.
Yeah, I've watched time and again people go down to the insurance company and collect, the value of their house, and then go back and rebuild another wooden plywood box in the middle of the forest. And it seems like, really, you should be building out of something that's not combustible.
So that, absolutely, and that knowledge and what you're bringing up is about what we're trying to teach folks in terms of living in fire-associated landscapes. And that, we talk about it, scientists talk about it, there's a fire ignition zone. It's not just the material of the house, but the vegetation, and within a 100 to 200 foot area roughly around the home itself is the other really important thing that people have to take as seriously as what you did with the construction of your dwelling, is how you manage that landscape directly adjacent to it. If those two things happen, honestly, it's very hard to burn a home down. Even if it's not all stone, if you are thoughtful, maybe you have some auxiliary water supply handy, you've got a resilient, you know, metal roof is absolutely the best. Materials, you got a deck that you're not storing all your firewood under. You don't have trees growing within inches of your house. All of those things, to me, are an indication that people are learning how to live in a fire-associated landscape. And I do speak from experience. I had my 40 feet of flame arrive in my front yard in 1994, and I had fire-wise treatments installed, I did, by hand around my home, and I still have that home I hand-built. So it is something really serious for community members and individual homeowners to take very seriously. There's tons of information about how to live fire-wise.
Steve, thanks for your call. We have to tie this up. So, Craig, thank you for coming in. Tell us how people can go online and find out about Sierra Forest Legacy.
www.sierraforestlegacy.org. And fire stuff is easily searchable there on a search engine. If you search fire, fire science, fire ecology, firewise communities, there's different pages for each one of those topics. And there's the fire MOU partnership on the homepage. You click on that and you can see how any individual or group that you belong to or agency or organization of any sort can join the Fire MOU partnership to promote fire use.
And Craig, I will thank you for coming in again in the near future as we move towards fire season. So we will be hearing you talk about this more, a lot more, in the near future.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm Al Stoller. This is Soundings on KVMR-FM in Nevada City.